Welcome to the Payments Journal Podcast. And here is your host, Ryan Mack.
Welcome to the Payments Journal Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Mack. Now, the CFPB has taken a particular interest in earned wage access this year, as individuals who seek to get immediate access to their funds they have earned has become more popular, especially with the growth of the gig economy. Now, this growth of popularity has caused the CFPB to take a closer look at vendor business models as it relates to EWA and impose regulation to better help protect consumers and also provide guidance and clarity of what business models fit under different protections and regulations. So to help simplify what can be a difficult and nuanced topic, I have DailyPay CEO Jason Lee and Mercator Advisor Group's Director of Debit and Alternative Products Advisory Service, Sarah Grotta. In this conversation, we will be referencing a rubric that was created by DailyPay that will help provide a visual to this conversation. So for those of you who are following along on paymentsjournal.com, you'll be able to view this rubric in the article below. So there is certainly a lot to dive into on this topic. So without any further delays, let's start the show.
So Jason and Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode. And I think that on today's episode, we're going to be talking about a really interesting announcement that's coming out of the CFPB as it relates to early wage access, or EWA. And so Jason, I'm hoping that we can start with you, and maybe you can kind of give us a little bit of a summary of what the CFPB announced, so that way then we can add a little bit of a context for this conversation here today.
Well, sure. Ryan, and you know, thanks for having me. We love spending a few minutes here with the folks at Payments Journal. So let me maybe back up for one moment and give a little bit of context for your listeners. This announcement has to do with an industry called on-demand pay, or earned wage access. And in a nutshell, it is broadly defined as an industry that really kind of works with employers and enables their employees to access their pay on their own schedule. One of the elements of these programs, and some of them rather in the marketplace, is some programs in the market do rely on providing funds to an employee and then actually requiring the employee to pay back the actual provider. And they can do that through a variety of means, either through having that provider debit a bank account or having the provider receive payment from the employee through an employer-directed payroll deduction. One of the tension points that has been sort of kicking around in the industry for those providers who utilize that model is really a fundamental tension point, which is, gosh, it feels like, you know, the employee is actually borrowing money in this context. And the reason why that is because when the employee receives funds, you know, they are required to pay it back to the end provider on the actual payday. And so that feels like it has a hallmark of a credit or borrowing transaction. Now, the tension point, of course, that's been created is, gosh, there is a payback of the funds occurring, but admittedly, it is a payback for something you've already earned. And so therein lies kind of the interesting theoretical point. And what this announcement that really happened on December 30th, I believe, of 2020 really did was it said, hey, look, you know, we understand that when an employee pays back someone for money that it took, gosh, that really is a borrowing transaction. However, in the context of this particular landscape, where it is admittedly for something they've already earned, you know, we, the CFPB, we're going to stipulate a bunch of conditions, but if you meet those conditions, well, then we're going to deem that not as credit. And that's really kind of the announcement that was made. As a sort of as a to really helicopter up, the earned wage access or on-demand pay business has a number of different business models that are out there, including, you know, our own here at DailyPay. This particular ruling only impacted those companies which require an employee payback, therefore kind of in this world of credit, and you know, we'll probably get into it, but they've kind of put some stipulations around how the employee can pay back.
You know, Jason, it's great to have you on this podcast, and I'm probably going to ask you some questions as well, just because you're an expert, and I think that there are still a lot of questions about this new area of payments. But when the CFPB came out with some of their announcements late last year, I actually see this as fairly helpful. I think that this industry requires a little bit more clarification, and I think coming from an organization at the federal level, that is also helpful, because you know, dealing with regulation at a state by state or entity by entity basis is much more harder to manage. Do you agree with that?
So it's a little bit of a nuanced answer. Here's what I would say. On-demand pay or earned wage access, you know, when we describe that industry, as I mentioned before, there are a number of sort of different business models within that industry, if that makes sense. And the clarification that, frankly, I thought was necessary was the one that we're seeing here, you know, which is, gosh, when an employee pays back the funds, is that or is that not credit? I don't want to take away, though, Sarah, from the other models that are encapsulated in the industry, which frankly never require the employee to pay back. In other words, there are models out there, frankly, including our own, which do not rely on the employee paying back through an employer payroll deduction. And that's really, you know, if I were to sort of describe kind of the decision tree, you know, number one, is the employee paying back through some type of payroll deduction, yes or no? If the answer to that is no, well, that actually is fairly clear. Like, that's sort of an unambiguous interpretation. I think the place that frankly needed interpretation is if you are in the earned wage access industry and you are relying on a payroll deduction, because frankly, that does feel like an employee payback, which then kind of takes you down this rabbit hole of, gosh, that really does look like credit. So I want to make sure that we are clear on that distinction, which is decision point one is, are you requiring an employee payback of the funds that you've remitted via an employer payroll deduction? Yes or no? If the answer to that is no, okay, like kind of period, full stop, the discussion's over. If the answer to that is yes, well, that's sort of why this order was required, and why it is that, you know, there's like this multi-factor test that needs to be applied, because frankly, in that category of transactions, it really does look like a borrowing. I mean, you know, you gave money to the employee, and on the payday, you're expecting that money back, and it's being paid back through the payroll deduction model. Does that make sense, Sarah?
Yeah, it does. That's a great overview.
Yeah, and I'm glad that we're really diving into the nuance part of this, because I think, Jason, you and I have had a conversation before when the CFPB was particularly looking at Regulation E as it relates to EWA here for it. And, you know, in that conversation, you know, I kind of expressed that initially I went down that same rabbit hole of going like, this feels extremely like a credit product. But then when you really dive into the nuances of what it is that's happening, you start to realize and you start to wrap your head around the fact that no, an employee has already earned these wages. So if it wasn't for the inefficiencies of payroll systems or business cash flow issues that are there, in theory, an employee could be paid every single hour for that they work. So it would be done in that manner. So it really, in that essence, you're not extending credit to somebody saying, hey, you can borrow this money. It's no, you're just getting access to the money that you've already earned. You earned it, but you're just not, in a traditional sense, you're not able to get access to that funds until payday is. But this is saying, well, okay, we will give you the money that you've already earned, and then it goes from there. But the other part that I want to bring up is that, you know, you're talking about how kind of nuanced this really is and kind of the clarifications for this. And I think that your organization, Daily Pay, created this really great analysis rubric here that kind of helps flush out what those nuances are. So perhaps maybe we could kind of flush out some of the nuances within this chart. And for those of you who are following along on paymentsjournal.com, we're going to have a copy to this analysis rubric down in the article below, so certainly feel free to check that out. But Jason, perhaps you could kind of unpack some of the key highlights here from this rubric.
Sure. Well, the first thing that I would say is this was really written or created, I think, from the employer's perspective. So let me sort of throw that out there first. If you look at the actual order that was issued, which I think probably you and your listeners are aware of, the actual safe harbor or order covers, in this case, a vendor called PayActive. But really, you know, for argument's sake, we can say it covers really any vendor or applies to any vendor that's utilizing a similar model by extension. What the order does not cover is the employer. And so let's just kind of pause on that point. This order stipulates, hey, the employer must do a number of different things as part of their program in order to make the vendor eligible for the safe harbor. And I want to make sure that's crystal clear in the analysis. You know, as I think probably you're aware of, whether or not a vendor is able to avail themselves of a safe harbor, it requires the underlying employer for whom they're working with to actually jump through a few hoops that we'll go through now to ensure that the vendor can be compliant. That's obvious from this order, given the fact that the order is not covering the employer. In other words, the safe harbor is applying, frankly, to the vendor to ensure that they are not a lender. So I think we should start kind of with that basic premise, which is, okay, this order says, hey, if the transaction as structured through the employer is done in a number of different ways, which we'll get into in a moment, well, then you PayActive, the entity that the CFPB issued the safe harbor to, is not considered to be a lending institution. And so I think that's sort of point number one. You know, at DailyPay, we tend to be very customer centric. You know, we tend to be much more focused on our employer partners. And so this chart that we created is really from the employer's perspective. And so if you were to think about it, you know, the very first question that the employer ought to be asking is, okay, in this program, is the employee being, you know, obligated to create some type of payment mechanism? In other words, hey, on payday, is there some type of obligation for me, the employer, to pay back some vendor through an employee-directed payroll deduction? So that's kind of step number one from the employer's perspective to figure out if they own this burden of doing a bunch of things to ensure that the vendor can be compliant. On the right-hand side, you'll see that if the answer to that question is no, meaning there is no repayment obligation by the employee, then if that answer is no, well, I think even the layman can understand, okay, I get it. The employee doesn't have to pay you back. That's not credit. And that's kind of where we and some others are in terms of our actual models. Real simple. The employee took some money and on payday, nothing's happening. And you know, the employer is not processing some type of payroll deduction to pay back the vendor. Well, that's real simple. That's not credit. On the other hand, if the answer to that question is yes, well, that's sort of where the flowchart comes into play, meaning, well, gosh, there is an obligation for the employee to pay back. Well, if that's the case, well, then that breaks off into two different channels itself. Is there debiting as the method of being paid back? In other words, hey, the vendor provided funds to the employee, and now the vendor is going back into the employee's bank account to take the money out of her account. Well, that's got, you know, that's sort of a key threshold issue that the CFPB is focused on. They are extremely focused on, hey, did you debit the employee's account to take out money? You'll see in this order that was released, actually, the order actually says, if you read the fine print, this order only applies to the states where debiting is not happening. I think in this particular vendor's case, they actually had to exclude three states in which they do debiting. And so it's actually a 47 state approval, not a 50 state approval, because that's a hot button issue for the commission. The commission doesn't want people going into your bank account to take out money, because that really is a clear hallmark of credit. If the program now, so excluding those states where there is debiting, there's a bunch of other states now where a payroll deduction is being processed. And if you look at this chart, it's very complicated, as you can see. But the short story is, a lot of these details of how that payroll deduction gets executed, like the employer needs to make sure that they are following all of these guidelines in order to allow or enable the vendor to be compliant with the safe harbor. And so these are kind of all the hair trigger responsibilities and hoops that the employer will now need to jump through in order to enable the vendor to avail itself of the safe harbor. For example, you know, the CFPB has said, gosh, if you are in fact requiring an employee payback and that employee payback is being done through a payroll deduction, well, we want to limit the amount of funds to, I believe it's 60% of the actual pay that's being paid out for the pay week. That's an incredibly onerous restriction for an employer to ensure that they're complying with. I mean, literally every week, they'd have to have reporting, compliance, auditing to ensure that they've limited themselves to 60%, because if they don't, then obviously the vendor per this order is not going to be compliant with the safe harbor. And that's going to create issues, of course, not only for the vendor, but also for the employer itself. Another issue, of course, is the 47 versus 50 state exemption. You know, we've got, you know, we've got folks within our customer base that are always moving across state lines. You know, my favorite example is Ohio, Cincinnati, and Kentucky. You know, as you guys may know, that you can just cross the state line very simply. You know, we work with the largest employers in the country, and they're always swapping employees back and forth between their Cincinnati and Kentucky locations because those stores are only 3 to 5 miles apart. Well, those states actually have very different treatments per this order. And so there's a lot of hair associated with ensuring compliance on this. And really that burden's gonna fall on the employer because ultimately the employer is gonna be responsible for keeping all of this so that the vendor can be compliant with the safe harbor. So I think that's kind of why we created this flowchart. We tend to be much more customer centric. What we say on our side is, well, look, let's forget about all of this. The technology will sort of not require a payroll deduction issued by the employer. And so because of that, it's not credit and we can sort of relax. And we at DailyPay can take that burden on for the employer. The employer just runs payroll as it always has. So that's a little bit of how we interpret this order is, gosh, there's a lot of now additional requirements for the employer to jump through. There, you know, none of that is, you know, prohibits them from doing it. It's just that sort of, hey, buyer beware. There's a lot of stuff here that you're going to have to do if you choose to go down this type of approach within the broader earned wage access industry.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of that is very important to point out there, that it really kind of seems like it creates a bit more friction, right? Because it's kind of a, hey, you have to comply with a lot more things here. But as you pointed out, it seems as though DailyPay is really kind of stepping in and saying, hey, look, like we understand that there's a lot of regulations now that or compliance things that are going to fit on you, the employer here, but we're willing to essentially have our system set up so it's you don't necessarily have to worry about these things because we're going to make sure that all these things fit within the compliance and regulation system of it for Safe Harbor so that within you, the employer, doesn't have to sit there, as you pointed out, and kind of going, okay, well, the hours change on, you know, a daily basis here. So what is, especially in that 60% mentioned there, like, well, what is actually 60% daily pay saying, okay, we're going to be able to help better manage that so that way then you're not sitting there constantly looking at the books and being like, okay, is everything squared away? Do I understand that correct?
Boy, Ryan, I got to tell you, you just said what I said over 4 minutes much more eloquently in 4 seconds. So you are very good at your job. Yes, that's it. You know, it's like my wife and I. We are, you know, we have very different approaches to the toothpaste. You know, I'm a squeeze from the top person, and she's a squeeze from the bottom person. Regardless of where you're squeezing from, the toothpaste has to go somewhere. And what I mean by that is the compliance burden has to be somewhere, and either it's the employer who's bearing it, or it's the vendor who's bearing it. And In our approach, we bear that, so the employer doesn't have to do it. You know, what this order basically is saying is, well, okay, the employer now needs to own a bunch of kind of out-of-the-box types of requirements. You know, as an example, you know, in our model, because we're not credit, we allow the employer to do, you know, from 0 to 100% of the actual pay. You know, we don't say, hey, you got to make sure it's, you know, capped at 60% exactly. Otherwise, you know, we're going to have a problem on our side. At the end of the day, like the toothpaste has to go somewhere. And in order for the instrument to not be considered credit, well, either you can, one, structure the program where the employee is in fact not paying you back, and so therefore it's not credit. That's real easy. Or you can sort of like do a bunch of stuff which comply with this order, which therefore then categorize it statutorily as not credit. So that's sort of, you know, you've just summarized this very eloquently.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you. I think that toothpaste analogy is certainly very fantastic. I think I'm going to have to use that in the future here. Now, I'm kind of curious, right, because I think we took the EWA industry here and kind of really separated it into two buckets here, where it was kind of the not having to pay back and then the kind of having to pay back side of things. But then within the not having to pay back, you had mentioned in terms of the debiting part of that. And I really want to get a deeper dive into that aspect. So with this announcement on 12/30/2020 here, you know, how does this order specifically affect those who rely on that portion of the debiting model in their business model here? And then maybe you could kind of enlighten us to, like, what is the percentage of the marketplace of organizations that actually fall under that category?
So look, let me start with this. Debiting, bad. Like that, like if there's one thing you can remember, debiting, bad. You know, every person out there, it doesn't matter if you are, if you have a lot of money, very little money, if you are a policy person, what your political orientation is. I think there's a universal principle out there, which is, hey, if you give money to someone, don't go into their bank account to take it, because that could cause all sorts of issues for overdraft. And I think you all know this, the cascading negative impact of, gosh, I went in there to take money out, the person didn't have it, now that caused an overdraft, now they can't even pay for that overdraft, so now there's another overdraft, and just the cycle, and trapping consumers in that cycle of debt, that's a big, big red flag no-no. And the commission basically has said that. If you look at, obviously, the safe harbor, they could not have been any more explicit that this does not apply to any vendor that is utilizing a debiting as a methodology of payback. And, you know, unfortunately, Ryan, it is a fairly significant percentage of the population that's doing that. I mean, look, even the applicant itself, you know, even the applicant itself, PayActive, they had to go, you know, and I didn't actually appreciate this myself, but it looks like they are debiting. I'm actually shocked by that, but they are debiting in a number of states, one of which is my hometown state of New York. You know, there are a lot of people here in New York. So it's a fair amount of the population that's affected, you know, affected by this. And so I would say that, you know, the commission was very, very clear on this. This is not a 50-state approved model if, in fact, you are debiting. And certainly this order eliminated all states by which, in this particular case, PayActive, but certainly others might be debiting. The reason why this is such a rife practice is, you know, unfortunately, the way these things work, it takes time and effort and partnership and technology to build a platform that does not have to rely on going into the bank account to take out the money. You know, I'm sure you can imagine, it's a lot easier to give someone money and say, hey, give me access to your bank account because I want to take the money back out. You know, that's frankly how storefront payday lenders work. And that's really simple and really easy. The hard way to do it is to build an entire platform that doesn't rely on that. And so that's kind of what we've been doing over the last couple of years, is building out that platform. We have never once debited an employee's account for methodology of payback. And so we'd like to be on that side of the line. But, you know, look, we understand that there are other providers who do that, but the commission could not have been more clear. That is a big no-no, and that is prohibited. And frankly, it's worse than that. It's not only excluded from the order, but essentially by implication, you can assume that if they did not include it, they have explicitly excluded it, if that makes sense. Meaning they have intentionally said, no, this is not allowed. And by implication, that in fact is credit. And so in those states, that in fact is a credit transaction, which obviously requires a whole new analysis for any employer who might be allowing a vendor to debit in those states.
I think what you said there was really critical, and it's an interesting point, I think, for employers who are looking at earned wage access when they're considering a particular vendor provider for their solution. Is it really gets into the sophistication of the platform of that particular provider, right? You need an organization that has the technical capabilities to be able to deliver solutions where you're not relying on things like debiting, right? I mean, to me, this in order to achieve this, you need to have a pretty good and deep integration into the employer's HR systems in order to adequately determine what the amount of wages can be in fact provided to the individual, so you're not caught up in that situation where you have advanced too much. I think, you know, when we think about, you know, employers and how do they make a decision about which vendor to choose, I think that's probably one of the most important.
Yeah, and look, I don't want to make this all about vendor selection. I mean, this is, you know, this is not a commercial for, you know, one vendor or another. I think, though, the heart of the issue, Sarah, is really the one that you're picking up on, which is, look, these are very serious matters. When you're dealing with employees' pay, from an employer standpoint, number one, they obviously have an obligation to make sure that goes smoothly. But number two, and this is unfortunate, when it comes to employees' pay, you know, that tends to be one of the hottest and most popular areas for, unfortunately, class action lawsuits, wage theft issues. And by the way, sometimes there are legitimate reasons for that. But a lot of these technical footfalls that could occur, you can imagine, you know, the plaintiff's bar. You know, looking at the left-hand side of this chart, Ryan, that you focused on. I mean, this is like a plaintiff lawyer's dream come true. I mean, look at all the technical footfalls here that could be occurring. And so, look, we're sort of simple people at Daily Pay. We just say, look, just run your payroll as you always have. You know, we will take on the burden behind the scenes of making all of this work. But from your books and records standpoint, you just run payroll as you always have. Just send 100% of the pay to the employee's direct deposit account and file. And, you know, and that's simple. Whereas if you look at the left-hand side of this chart, my goodness, you can imagine, you know, unscrupulous plaintiff's attorneys being very, very excited about trying to identify technical footfalls that may have occurred.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I think you're kind of hitting on here is also just like the overall experience of it, right? Because I mean, when you look at it, you know, from the debit side of things, or those certain vendors that use the debit, it's, you know, you could potentially fall into those pitfalls where you're talking about, okay, there's the overdraft and it goes there. And from the employee's perspective, then they look at that and they're like, well, this is a horrible experience. Why would I want to use this again? Because now I'm caught up in all this overdraft. I've got all these other issues here that I have to deal with, and I quite frankly don't want to deal with them. I live paycheck to paycheck. I needed to use this service to get access to those wages to maybe pay a medical bill or whatever the case may be. And then it's also the experience from the employer's perspective as well too. It's a, hey, yes, I would like to offer this service to my employees, but at the same time, I don't want to necessarily be responsible for all these additional things. I have to focus on running my business first. That comes first and foremost to that. And then making sure that I comply with making sure that my employees get paid. So I think it does come also down to the overall experience side of things. And that kind of having the model that Daily Pay does have really fits better with that overall experience. So now with that being said, maybe perhaps you could kind of explain why it is that you decided on the employer-based model when you launched Daily Pay 6 years ago.
Gosh, Ryan, has it been 6 years, man? Time flies. Well, look, we are an employer-first organization. You know, we have something that we say here, which is the partner, which is our terminology for the employer. The partner is the center of our strategy. And what we mean by that is everything that we do, every technology decision we make, every financial decision we make, every resource allocation we make, it literally is dedicated. This is going to sound funny, but it's dedicated to ensuring that the employer doesn't do any work. And let me explain what I mean by that. Every piece of technology, every line of code, everything that we are doing, it's all geared towards how do we make sure that we can offer this product, which, by the way, is fundamentally disruptive and is fundamentally transformative for the workforce. But how do we do that in a way where we can build technology that eliminates any change management by the employer? Said differently, our technology is absorbing all of that change that's occurring because, look, it's pretty fundamental here. You used to pay once every 2 weeks. Now your employees can get paid whenever they want. That's a meaningful change, right, in the experience of the employee. But the key to the technology is to create this absorption quality where the employer literally doesn't even know that that's happened. I mean, they just run payroll as they always did, you know, once every 2 weeks, no change to that process, because that technology that we've created is absorbing and consuming all of that change management. So unequivocally, categorically, we are an employer first model, an employer centric business. That's why if you look at this flow chart, we're on the right hand side. We don't want to change anything about the employer's process. We want to absorb all of that change management and all of the compliance burden. We don't want to put any of that on the employer. And so that, like, we talk a lot about that here, which is our North Star is every line of code that we write has to be directed towards eliminating all aspects of change management for the employer. We would love the employer to forget that we even exist. You know, and you know, obviously, if you're processing weekly payroll deductions, running reports to make sure you haven't exceeded 60%, God forbid, keeping track of people's, do they live in Ohio but work in Kentucky? You know, all of those things. Well, you will not only remember that we exist, you'll probably curse that we exist if that's the approach that we're taking. So yeah, like we literally try to erase ourselves off the face of the earth and be a silent partner to the employer.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that makes perfect sense, right? Because, I mean, technology is there to help people, not to put additional burdens on top of people. I mean, that's the whole reason for innovation. And I think, you know, it's kind of funny that you talk up of like, hey, you know, Daily Pay is really meant to kind of erase itself from existence. But the theme that I'm starting to hear more and more throughout the industry that especially fintechs are jumping on is kind of, you know, becoming really successful by fading into the background. And I think that's a very important point that a lot of fintechs really kind of need to focus on because, you know, as you pointed out, it's, hey, if your technology is correct in providing the correct services, it really should be helping to solve the problem and not putting additional burdens on whomever it is that it's trying to serve. It really should be eliminating all those issues on the back end. For it. But now I kind of want to jump back a little bit to the payroll deduction side of things. So what issues do payroll deductions present on a state-by-state basis? And are they considered illegal in several states?
Yeah, so gosh, payroll deductions, and I presume you're asking this because it was in the actual order itself. So let me try to unpack this arc a little bit. So point one, what is a payroll deduction, or what's the relevance of a payroll deduction in the context of something like this? A payroll deduction in the context of earned wage access is a way for the employee to pay back funds. So in other words, the employee took money and says, hey, I'd like to pay you back, Mr. Vendor, by having my employer just cut a check to you. Employee's still paying back. It just happens to be through the actual payroll deduction. You know, that looks like a borrowing transaction. And so consequently, that's why the clarification needed to get issued. So that's sort of why this is even relevant to this discussion. What the order, however, did not specify is whether or not a payroll deduction causes other issues. And the other issues that are relevant, which I know are a little bit out of scope for quote unquote payments journal, but in our business, we pay a lot of attention to what are called wage and hour rules under the FLSA, as well as the constructive receipt rules under the IRS tax withholding guidance. To say it very bluntly, when issuers or when employers process payroll deductions, they have to be very mindful of whether or not that payroll deduction is going to constitute something called in a prohibited or an illegal wage discount or illegal wage deduction, which is the case in about 14 states across the US. The less technical way of saying that is there are a bunch of rules out there that say employers cannot dock your pay for other than standard deductions like taxes or garnishments. And by the way, those are good rules. You know, they protect employees. And so the tension that gets created, and frankly, every like sophisticated employer is aware of this, is you can't dock people's wages for you know, whenever you feel like it. And so whilst the model that was used in the application process did talk about payroll deductions, that doesn't mean that is, you know, the CFPB, which reports obviously separately than the wage and hour folks do, which reports through DOE, which by the way is different than the IRS, which reports through the Department of Treasury. These are all different jurisdictions. And so it's not as if one was saying, hey, thank you for this application, you're now clear to go across all these other different jurisdictions. So I think, you know, the key point to sort of see here is, yes, the example used was a payroll deduction, but that does not mean you then don't have to make sure that that is compliant in other types of jurisdictions, if that makes sense. And so I think that's the technical issue. Again, we don't rely on payroll deductions because frankly, we don't want employers to have to use like all these different methodologies to try to get the money back to the vendor. More broadly though, again, because you had mentioned the employer perspective, again, like we're real simple people. We just say, hey, look, just run the payroll as you always did. Just send 100% of the pay to the employee's direct deposit account. We'll take care of the rest. And just from an employer experience standpoint, that's really easy. Meaning they just run payroll as they always have, versus, you know, having to process a weekly or a biweekly payroll deduction. What if there's not enough money? What if the guy had a garnishment? What if there were back taxes that were due? What if there was a healthcare disability that was accruing? You know, there's all these sorts of issues and confusion that gets created when you start mucking around with the employee's final paycheck. And frankly, that's just burden that will be sitting on top of the employer. Again, we think the technology should really fix those issues so the employer doesn't have to deal with that reconciliation on the actual payday.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly think that's really kind of the theme of this entire conversation here, really, is just, again, as you pointed, just that the technology is built there to help, not to hinder, to solve problems, not to make more problems on that end. And now kind of towards the beginning of our conversation here, and I kind of want to wrap up with this, you know, we talked about, you know, when we're talking about the debiting side of programs like this, that there can certainly cause some issues or some kind of like really not savory practices that may be particularly happening. So perhaps maybe we could talk a little bit more about those risks that are associated with the debiting on the employer side, and really kind of focusing on that aspect of it, if we could kind of dive a little bit deeper into it.
Look, debiting is a very abrasive activity. I think you can probably imagine. So someone on payday goes into my bank account. The day, by the way, where I'm expecting to get money, because that's the payday. Well, now I've got the opposite effect. Someone is going into my account to take money. And that's a very abrasive and frankly disruptive and confusing, for that matter, practice for employees. Let me give you an analogy, Ryan. Have you ever had a situation where, like, your cable company or maybe your phone company or power company, you know, maybe there was some mistake, or maybe there was a refund, or, you know, something of that order? But have you ever seen, like, a double print? In other words, where, like, money goes into your account, but then they, like, debit it and it goes right back out. And so you see the, you know, plus 200, and then right next to it, the minus 200. And, you know, I've seen that from time to time in my own bank account. And no matter how, you know, clear, or no matter how many, you know, how much time I've spent on the phone with Verizon, or, you know, in my case, Time Warner here in New York, it still makes me feel a little uncomfortable. Like, did they do that right? Did they not do it right? Boy, that looks really weird. And, you know, you can imagine, for someone who's living paycheck to paycheck, that's a really uncomfortable situation. So money went in and then it went right back out. And just the amount of stress that it takes to try to reconcile all these numbers. Well, was the debit for the right amount? Did I really take that amount earlier? And here's the issue. You know, for better or for worse, a lot of people just don't remember that, you know, it may in fact be a legitimate debiting transaction, but frankly, a lot of people just don't remember. This is a very high stress population. They're living paycheck to paycheck. They may not recall what they actually took out. They may not frankly remember what they agreed to. And so where does that actual stress go? It goes to the employer. What we hear time and time again from companies who switch from vendors that debit to daily pay is, I just couldn't handle answering my employees' phone calls and trying to reconcile their bank statements. And we hear that time and time again, because ultimately, when the employee is confused, the first person they go to is actually not the vendor. They go to their employer. They go straight to the payroll department. They say, hey, look, I think this vendor that you told me to use is doing something shady. You know, help me understand this. I mean, I literally have payroll professionals telling me, like, I'm getting screenshots of someone's bank account statement, and I just don't want to be involved in that anymore. Yeah. And so, and look, maybe you or I don't do that, but frankly, when you're living paycheck to paycheck and where you feel like someone took $88 from you that they shouldn't have, you better believe they're going to call the payroll department.
Yeah, I think that's extremely valid, because it's not just on that case. I mean, when you look at, again, especially a lot of fintechs that are entering the space, I mean, just from a financial institution perspective that might partner with them, it's not the fintech that gets the calls. It's not that end vendor that gets the calls. It's the financial institution that goes, hey, what is going on here? Like, I don't understand. And the financial institution most of the time is kind of like, I don't know either. I don't have all that insight to it, but then creates frustration. So it's that the consumer is putting the blame, in this instance that I'm giving here, on the financial institution, when that might not be the correct place to put it. And in the example that you gave, it's, hey, I'm going to go back to, you know, the person who's in charge of payroll and go, like, what's going on here? And that individual person might not have great insight, because they're like, well, I don't know particularly what that vendor did, why it is that they put 200 in there and then took 200 out kind of in the same day, and what that means and where that came from and what it all is. And it's additional time that payroll person has to put. It's an additional resource that the business has to spend to be able to go in and say, okay, now I've got to spend time to research what exactly happened, to maybe come out and find out that the vendor was like, oh yeah, we did this just because of some small issue and we resolved it by just putting it in, taking it out, and then that solved it. But that's still time that the business has to spend. That's still a resource the business has to put towards to figure out the problem that goes there, versus a solution like DailyPays that comes across and says, hey, you just do what you do normally from a payroll perspective. We're going to kind of handle the other things on the other end and also make sure that it meets all these compliance and regulations on these ends. So you're not going to get those calls. You don't have to put that additional resource. And then the employer also has that better customer experience because they can deal directly with us. We can answer those questions directly from there. They know that they're associating themselves with directly with us, as opposed to, no, this came through kind of a third party, so talk to the payroll, then come talk to us. So it eliminates a lot of just the customer friction and kind of poor customer service, and then also creates that freed up resource that payroll people may have to deal with if any complications arise on that end. So I certainly think that that's a fantastic way to look at the process. And I think is a great way of seeing that DailyPay is kind of looking at the marketplace and seeing that, hey, this is the correct way to go about doing business in this industry. So Jason, Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time today for speaking to me about this announcement coming out of the CFPB. And I hope to have both of you on the podcast real soon.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan.